thought, and finally nodded in approval. I couldn't help feeling proud of myself.
Remember what I've taught you, she said. Astrid may be among the lowliest of the servants, but she knows what forks to use. She knows the steps to the dances. Being a maid is only one step removed from being a princess. Don't do anything to remind them you're neither.
She grabbed my shoulder with one hand and placed the other on my spine, jerking me upright.
Watch your posture. Dorothy can't abide a sloucher, and neither can I. Walk around like that and you'll be fired in a week, or worse.
I looked into the scrying pool mirror one last time. Like Mombi, I missed my pink hair. And while I knew I wasn't Amy Gum anymore, I didn't feel like Astrid either. I was still looking at myself when Mombi spoke up.
Enough of this. It's time for you to go.
She reached into her robe, pulled out something that looked like a pebble, and dropped it into the pool. I leaned over to watch as it rippled in concentric circles and then began to glow. When I looked up, Mombi was already gone.
She's always been awful at goodbyes, Glamora said sadly. But I'll say one. Goodbye, darling. You'll be fabulous.
She opened her arms and pulled me into a deep hug. It was nice of her, but I think we both knew she wasn't Gert. After a moment, she let me out of her embrace.
I'll let the two of you say your farewells in private, she said, blowing me a final kiss before leaving.
It was just me and Nox now. I'd never seen him so quiet. He was staring at the scrying pool, which was showing the map of the palace again. I have a list of Dorothy's likes and dislikes and schedule. Memorize it and then destroy it. He held the list out toward me. When my hand grazed his, he grabbed on tight. He closed the gap between us without taking a step, and his mouth closed over mine before I could speak. He was kissing me. I closed my eyes and let go of everything except him for a few seconds. I had never kissed a boy before, so I had nothing to compare it to. But I was sure that whatever it was like, kissing Nox had to be different. Because Nox was different. Power and magic flowed between us like when he'd first showed me what magic was. But it wasn't magic at all this time. It was something completely human. Things we couldn't or wouldn't say with millions of words were all there, all at once. Everything we shared and everything we were was contained in this single, perfect moment. When we broke, he was breathing hard and I wasn't breathing at all. The candles in the cave suddenly blew out. Was it us? Or had Mombi sent a gust telling us to hurry up? He composed himself, letting his arms drop to his sides, but he was still standing within kissing distance. That will never happen again, he began. My stomach dropped. Was it that awful? I wondered. But it would be too bad if it didn't happen once, he finished. I just wish I'd gotten to do it when you still looked like yourself. I wasn't hurt. I didn't have time to be hurt. And he was right. He didn't want us distracted by each other. It was too dangerous. Until Dorothy was dead, I couldn't care about the way I looked, or about what Nox thought about me, or about what Glamora had done to Astrid. I didn't know what was good or wicked anymore. All I knew was what was right. What do I do? I asked. Isn't it obvious?
Knox pointed at the pool, which was still glowing in concentric circles, pulsing outward from where Mombi had dropped the pebble. He smiled a smile that looked like a secret. You jump. I couldn't wait any longer. If I didn't do it now, I'd never have the guts. So I took a deep breath and a running start and dove head first into the shallow water. Chapter 26. A moment later, I emerged out of a full-length mirror in a sloppy somersault. As I righted myself, I realized I was in a dim, musty room that was so small I could almost touch both walls by stretching my arms out. I wasn't even wet. I stood up and looked in the mirror. Astrid stared back at me. I touched the cool glass. Solid now. No way back. And reminded myself that this was me standing there. This was me in Dorothy's dumb servant attire. Frilly white shirt, pleated green skirt, apron, and red patent leather Mary Janes that seemed like a mocking approximation of Dorothy's sky-high pumps. Cute. I smoothed down my skirt and adjusted the apron, looking around while fighting back a wave of nausea at being in one of the palace's tiny rooms. I needed to get used to it quick. After all, this was my new home. The servants' quarters weren't much better than my cell had been. There was a little white bed with threadbare sheets printed with Ozma's faded crest, and a dresser with peeling paint that had seen better, grander days. A small silver bell sat on top of the dresser. That was pretty much it. It made my room back in Dusty Acres seem lavish, and that room hadn't even had walls. I yanked open the top drawer of the dresser, not expecting to find much. I was right. There were three uniforms identical to the one that I was already wearing, and a couple of plain cotton dresses, one in a plain green satin and another in white. Glamora had told me that every maid had two dresses aside from her uniform, one for escorting Dorothy to parties and one for her monthly day off. So, this was it. It didn't take long to search the rest of my sad accommodations. I got excited for a second when I reached underneath the mattress and pulled out a battered old book. Maybe it was a diary. Some extra insight into servant life would come in handy. Hell, maybe Astrid had documented the one day a month Dorothy sunbathed in the warm glow of the Emerald City's rusty knife recycling pile. That'd make my task easier. Either I wasn't that lucky, or Astrid wasn't that interesting. Or both. It was just a dog-eared copy of a trashy but famous Oz romance called The Quadling and the Gnome, one of the more boring books Glamora had forced me to read during our cram sessions. I tossed it aside in frustration and sat down onto the bed. I was all alone for the first time in weeks, and I had absolutely no idea what I was supposed to do next. Out of boredom, I opened my palm and was about to light a small magic flame when I remembered Knox's warning not to use magic. I snapped my hand shut and leaned back. So much for my plan to pass the time by staring at fire. I sighed. Boredom, I said aloud, thy name is assassining. It was only then that I realized I was overlooking the one friend I did have in the palace. Well, make that two friends. Friend number one, Star the Rat, who was, in theory, still being kept safe by friend number two, Pete. Pete. I'd almost forgotten him. Was he here? Did he know I'd managed to escape, I wondered, or how I'd managed to do it? Even if I found him, there was no way of telling him I was okay. I was Astrid now. And even though I had a good feeling about Pete, my witch-trained side knew I couldn't take any unnecessary risks. I was supposed to follow the plan. Watch and wait. I sat. I watched. I waited. I almost jumped out of my maid's costume when the bell on the dresser rose a few inches into the air and began to ring. I knew it meant that someone in the palace needed service. I knew about the bell because Astrid knew about the bell. The spell Mombi had cast didn't give me access to her memories, not exactly, but it did give me a vague sense of her instincts. What Astrid would do in this situation came through as a foreign tickle in the back of my mind. I walked over to the bell and cautiously picked it up. It rang louder. I held it at arm's length toward the door. It got louder still. When I placed it back on the table, the tinkling chime faded. It was like a game of hot and cold. The bell was telling me which way to go. So, me and the bell walked out the door, down one hall and then another, and another, and another. At each corner, I listened carefully, judging which way to go. The bell was getting louder and louder as I roamed through the palace. How big was this place? When I reached a carved oak doorway, the ringing stopped. I'd really been hoping the bell would lead me to one of the normal doors, but of course it put me in front of this monstrosity at the end of the hall. The door was carved into a landscape scene that twisted and moved as I stared at it, almost like crude animation. In it, dozens of blackbirds repeatedly dropped dead over an endless field of corn. I knocked, and then jumped back as a blackbird exploded into a puff of feathers beneath my knuckles. An impatient, somewhat familiar voice told me to enter. My heart sank when I saw the scarecrow sitting on the edge of his bed in the corner of the room, waiting for me. Or rather, waiting for Astrid. "Yes, your royal scarecrow?" I chirped in my sweetest voice, even though I was shaking on the inside. I was face to face, and alone, with the monster who'd experimented on Melindra. I felt my hand tingling, and I was comforted with the knowledge that my knife was there if I needed to summon it. The scarecrow's room looked less like a bedroom and more like an enormous, filthy study. Every surface was cluttered with loose papers and dirty plates and bits of straw. The whole place smelled stale and moldy, like the bootleg firewood our neighbor used to wheelbarrow around Dusty Acres. Lying on the floor near my feet, I noticed a bound leather book open to a drawing of a monkey's internal anatomy, with little notes in shaky handwriting penciled in the margins. I shivered and forced myself to look away, letting my eyes travel upward, where walls of bookshelves stretch beyond the reach of the candlelight. "Well, what took you so long?" the scarecrow snapped. My eyes snapped too, back down to where he sat, his creepy button eyes looking right through me. "Why didn't you just zap yourself to me?" "Zapping is forbidden in the palace," I said, the words out before I could even think about them. I let out an internal sigh of relief when the scarecrow seemed exasperated, but not suspicious. "You should know by now that those silly rules don't apply when I ring," he grumbled. He gave me a meaningful look. "Oh, no," I thought. "Please Please, please don't tell me he's Astrid's secret boyfriend. But he just scowled as he gestured toward a square metal tray that was sitting on a table next to his bed. I'm feeling duller by the second here. Doing my best not to disturb his mess, I carefully stepped over piles of junk and picked up the tray. It took everything I had to stay calm when I saw what was actually on it. Knives and scalpels and curved needles and pliers and an assortment of other things I didn't even want to think about. Some of them were still bloody. These were probably the same tools this monster used to dissect and experiment on innocent Ozzians, on people like Melindra. And what did he want me to do with them? I was still trying to figure it out as he casually leaned his stuffed body against his bed's ornate headboard and started removing a series of straight pins from his scalp, dropping each one carefully into a metal wastebasket near his feet. I noticed that they had blood on them, too. I cleared my throat and nodded toward the horror show of instruments on the tray. What would you like me to do with these tonight, Your Eminence? I kept my voice detached, like a good subjugated servant girl, even as my skin crawled at the scene before me. I hadn't been prepared to face the Scarecrow within minutes of my arrival. I hadn't been prepared for the Scarecrow at all. He looked me up and down with his dead and shiny button eyes. I want you to do the same thing I always want. What's gotten into you? Without waiting for me to answer, he plucked a scalpel up from the tray I held and began carefully using it to break apart the stitches that held his canvas skull together. I got started without you. The syringe is already filled. I noticed it then. A syringe, with a needle at least 4 inches long, was sitting right there next to the rest of the bloody utensils. I picked it up, wishing I'd learned a spell to keep my hand steady. When I turned around, the Scarecrow was lifting the flap off his head, revealing his brain. I'd seen a monkey brain once in biology class. This was kind of like that, only pinker and goopier. The whole thing was suspended in red, gelatinous mush that I'd mistaken for blood. I picked up the syringe. I gave it a little squirt like I'd seen nurses do on hospital shows. Where was I supposed to stick it? My borrowed Astrid instincts were quiet. Maybe the magic only went so deep, or maybe she'd done such a good job blocking out these traumatizing scenes that they didn't transfer over. Or maybe my own instinct to run away screaming was overriding my Astrid sense. Either way, I stood there holding the needle like a dummy. When I waited a moment too long, his gloved hand shot up and grabbed my wrist with a steel grip. His hold was tight, yet I could feel his straw insides crunching as he squeezed. I almost flinched away, but that wouldn't be an Astrid move. I kept my eyes downcast and frightened. Get it right, girl, or I'll be the one sticking needles into you next. Yes, sir, I said meekly, adding a shudder that wasn't entirely feigned. When he let go, I went for it, jamming the needle into the pinkest part of his brain mass. Part of me hoped there might be an air bubble in the needle or something, and my next job as servant girl would be mopping bits of Scarecrow off the walls. I pushed the plunger, releasing the fluid. The Scarecrow let out a long moan of relief. His head lolled over on his shoulder, and a little felt tongue I didn't even know he had dangled limply from his mouth. I willed myself not to throw up. Oh, he moaned again. I pulled the needle out and put it back on the tray, slowly backing away. Do you know how many brains I had to drain for this stuff? The thing is, he wasn't looking at me. It sounded more like he was talking to himself. He barely seemed to remember I was there at all. It's exhausting, he continued, but it's the price they must pay to have the finest brain in all of Oz. Yes, sir, I mumbled. I'll sew myself back up. It's good to let it breathe for a bit. He waved me away, a bit of straw escaping from his cuff. Take the trash on your way out, girl. I grabbed the wastebasket, almost tripped over myself curtsying, and got the hell out of there. As long as I didn't think too much about it, and if I followed my feet and let the spell do the work, I knew my way around the palace. After only one wrong turn, I finally found my way to the kitchen, which seemed as good a place as any to dispose of the scarecrow's garbage. It was empty now for the brief window between cleaning up after dinner and getting ready for breakfast. The place was even more huge than I had expected, which was fitting, considering the size of the palace, not to mention the size of Dorothy's appetites. One wall was lined with a row of old-timey stoves, while a row of sinks dominated the other. At the end of the kitchen was a fireplace, a small fire dancing behind the grate. I tossed the whole wastebasket in. It burned down to dust in an instant. When I turned around, I was no longer alone. Ozma was standing in the doorway. She wore a nightgown so sheer I could see her pale, almost translucent skin through it. Her big green eyes were unblinking, glowing brightly in the kitchen's candlelight. I was pretty sure she hadn't noticed me. I held my breath and stepped aside into a shadow. But as I moved, the princess let out a lilting giggle, and I saw that her eyes were trained right on me. I'd been discovered. "Pardon me, Your Majesty," I said, curtsying deeply and praying I hadn't done anything technically against the rules. Again, she giggled. It had a manic, almost crazed quality to it. "Is there anything I can do for you?" I asked quietly and carefully. "May I assist you to your quarters?" She smiled and clapped her delicate hands together. "Quarters! Halves!" she exclaimed in delight, and then her face immediately drooped into a frown. "And have-nots." So this was the one true princess of Oz. It was obvious to anyone that she was broken somehow. I wondered if this was what she did every night, if she just wandered around the palace reaching for whatever shiny objects caught the attention of her spooky green eyes and spouting weirdo puns. I turned to go. I didn't want to be around if she started banging on pots and pans or something. But as I tiptoed around her into the empty hallway, she called after me. "Dorothy knows," she sing-songed. I stopped and turned back, wondering what she meant. What if there was a little bit of Ozma still in there? "What does she know?" I asked, forgetting myself. She began to sing. "Backward rivers, Dorothy knows, lion's den, scarecrow's nose." Oh, it was just more nonsense. "What happened to you?" I wondered, but I knew it wasn't worth it to ask. Ozma's hand reached out for mine as I tried to skirt past her. Her grip was surprisingly strong for someone so frail and thin that I could practically see through her. I tried to shake her loose, to no avail. "Ozma, Your Majesty, you have to let me go or I'll get into trouble." She gave me an angelic smile and patted my hair with her free hand. It was like my mom, mid-bender.
"What does the owl say?" she asked me.
I inspected her face to see if there was even a hint of understanding. If there was anyone at all at home. It didn't look like it. I'd taken too long to respond, so this time her question was louder, echoing through the kitchen.
"What does the owl say?"
"Please be quiet, Your Majesty," I hissed. But when it looked like she was about to ask me again, I gave in.
"Who?
The owl says who?"
"Are you?"
she demanded, cocking her head to the side.
"Astrid,"
I replied, trying to stay calm, her clammy hand still on my wrist.
"I'm Astrid."
She replied, pointing at my chest.
"Naughty liar."
I yanked away from her, more violently than I'd intended. Ozma teetered like an antique vase, and then started to fall over. I had time to picture the Princess of Oz cracking her head on the cobbled kitchen floor. That'd make for a pretty atrocious first night of espionage. I leapt forward to steady her. Before I could even apologize for almost knocking her over, Ozma latched on to me. She put her lips right up against my ear.
"I'll never tell," she whispered.
And then, out of nowhere, she grabbed my chin and turned my head, kissing me softly on the cheek. Her lips were soft and smooth.
"What the hell?"
I pulled back gently and looked at her. Her eyes were wide open, too. She was still studying me. This time, though, she let me go. Without another word, Ozma resumed her wandering, leaving me in the kitchen to wonder if my cover was already blown. Chapter 27.
"Today is a beautiful day to be in Oz."
The lilting sweet voice wafted across the crowded table in the servants' mess hall where I was eating breakfast with the rest of the maids. I was starting to sweat, and not just because this was the first time my Astrid identity needed to stand up to mass scrutiny. It was humid in the mess hall, the room seeming to trap all the heat from the kitchen. There were about 20 girls huddled shoulder to shoulder around the long, rough-hewn table. No boys. The butlers and footmen I'd seen hustling around must take their meals at a different time. Jelaya Jam sat at the head of the table, the one who'd spoken with such unironic chipperness about what a beautiful day it was to be a servant. Jelaya was in charge of the downstairs staff. She had a sickly sweet smile on her face, and she looked like she was a few seconds away from bursting into song. She poised her fork above her plate and held it there. Everyone else followed suit. Jelaya was pretty, with rosy pink skin and golden blonde hair. As the head maid, her uniform was a deeper, richer emerald green than the rest of our pale, washed-out shades that were somewhere between sea foam and olive. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I'd hoped I'd get the chance of a glimpse of Pete when the staff gathered, but no luck. If I was going to see him, it wasn't going to be at mealtimes. We were dining on a spread left over from Dorothy's dinner last night, which meant we were eating dinner and dessert for breakfast. Braised ribs, truffle-infused mashed potatoes, chocolate cake. The fact that my mouth was watering felt like some small betrayal of the order. Even the maid's food in the palace was a million times better than what the order cooked up in the caves. Still, I would have given anything to have Gert make me some green goo again, something other than the table scraps of a flouncy despot. And, back at the caves, I could eat without feeling that everyone was staring at me, picking up on whatever giveaway Ozma had noticed the night before. Green goo was a lot less stressful and a lot more ethically delicious.
"Praise Dorothy,"
Jelaya said, and 19 forks descended in unison. Mine was just a second behind. Glamora was right. The girls had perfect manners, and in that moment, I was thankful that she'd trained me so vigilantly. But there was something else, something a little eerie. They were more than perfect. They were synchronized. Every girl's fork met her lips at the exact same moment and touched down on their plates again, like clockwork.
"Dorothy has been very generous. She was pleased with last night's service. She didn't actually say so, but I could tell. She didn't have a single complaint. Well, except about the bread, but that wasn't our doing, and I'm sure Her Highness knows that. Aren't we lucky to work for someone as kind and understanding as Princess Dorothy?"
This girl was cheerful. Too cheerful. Dorothy wasn't even here, and this was at least the 11th compliment she'd heaped on the princess before we'd even started eating. And I'd hate to see what happened to the poor person who screwed up Dorothy's bread, whoever that was.
"Astrid, are you all right?" Jelaya asked as I took a braised rib from the serving dish at the center of the table.
I looked up, startled. "I'm fine."
"You never eat that,"
the girl next to me, whose name I'd learned was Hannah, said suspiciously. "Maybe she's trying to put on some weight," offered another maid named Syndra. Her eyelashes were extra long, and she'd tied her hair into tight pigtails, almost like an homage to Dorothy. I swallowed hard. Was Astrid a vegetarian? Had my stomach just given me away? I shrugged as lightly as possible.
"I guess I'm just extra hungry this morning," I said, trying to match the other girl's perky tone and keep pace with their synchronized eating. "If it's good enough for Dorothy herself, it's certainly good enough for me."
That seemed to satisfy them. Jelaya nodded as if my logic was too unimpeachable to argue with, and I went back to trying to chew daintily, hoping I wouldn't make any other mistakes. I kept my antennae up for intel, but the only subject of conversation was Dorothy, which should have been a good thing, considering that she was the one I was really here to learn about. Unfortunately, no one was sharing any useful information. It was all about how beautiful Dorothy was, or how kind she was, or how lucky we were to be working for the greatest person in all of Oz. It was weird. They were like a creepy, overeager maid sorority. By the end of breakfast, I found my fork moving in time with the other maids. I found myself nodding when they nodded, chewing when they chewed, blinking when they blinked. Part of me was proud for how easily I'd blended in, a necessity if I was going to complete my mission. But another part of me wondered if maybe the whole automaton routine wasn't coming a little too easily. Was it magic, I wondered? A spell to make us as orderly as possible? Did Dorothy have some kind of charm working to keep us from eating like slobs or tapping our forks? Or was the clockwork perkiness machine just the maid's way of dealing with the constant fear of living under Dorothy? Breakfast didn't last long. Jelaya merrily reminded us how much work we'd been blessed with and hustled us off to our tasks. Every room in the palace was cleaned every day, regardless of whether or not anyone was using it. "I wish we could use magic for this," I said leadingly to Hannah, glancing at her over our big bucket of soapy water. We were hunched on our hands and knees, scrubbing oil stains from the floor of the Tin Woodman's suite. My floor scrubbing was pretty half-assed, since I was too busy checking out the Tin Woodman's living space to really bother with my job. Except that his room was almost as boring as mine. The room was completely devoid of personal effects whatsoever, other than spare parts. The only thing that interested me was a strange contraption that was bolted to the wall, made up of two long metal brackets that held an ancient-looking mattress, suspended about a foot off the floor in a perfectly vertical position. Just under it, a pair of boot-shaped scuff marks had become so etched into the wood that I was sure no amount of scrubbing would remove them. At first, I couldn't figure out what it was. Then it dawned on me. This was the Tin Woodman's bed. He slept standing up. The whole place gave me the creeps. On the other hand, at least we weren't cleaning the Scarecrow's room. That would have been terrifying. Not to mention, it would take all week. Hannah shot me a sidelong look and lowered her voice.
"You know using magic would be wasteful, Astrid. Dorothy needs it, every drop. Besides, doing the work the old-fashioned way is comforting to Dorothy. It reminds her of how she used to clean the farm back in the other place."
"You don't need to lecture me about comforting Dorothy," I replied quickly. "It's my whole reason for being here." Hannah smiled at me and I smiled back, hoping to match her cheerily vacant quality. "I'm so glad our slaving away makes Dorothy feel better," I muttered, pretty sure Hannah wasn't the type to detect sarcasm.
"It really does," Hannah exclaimed. "It reminds her how far she's come."
The soap we were using had a lemony, peachy smell. I wondered if this was the soap that her Auntie Em used to use back in Kansas, before the tornado whisked her away. What could have happened to turn that sweet, innocent farm girl into this magic-hoarding fascist? I wasn't going to get any useful assassination tips out of a frightened airhead like Hannah, so I decided to poke around and see if there was any way I could get her to give up some information about Pete. Even posing as Astrid, I figured tracking down the only other anti-Dorothy person I knew of might be helpful, and surely servants cozying up wouldn't raise any red flags. Not that I wanted to cozy up with Pete. "Have you seen that boy around with the crazy green eyes?" I asked casually. "I wonder when he takes his break." Hannah looked up at me, surprised.
"Who? You mean one of the guards?"
"No, I think he's a gardener."
"Oh, don't be silly, Astrid," she said.
I blinked. "What do you mean?"
"You know any fraternization is strictly forbidden."
"Oh," I said, trying to figure out a way to cover my mistake. Before I could, Hannah leaned in close enough to whisper.
"I let Bryce, you know, the baker I was telling you about, sneak into my room the other night," she whispered. "But don't tell anyone. I don't want to get punished for smuttiness again." "I promise I won't," I whispered back. I'll keep an eye out for your boy, too, Hannah said. But I haven't seen anyone with eyes like that. I leaned in close to the floor, trying to scrub away a particularly stubborn piece of dirt. Who was Pete? After we finished the Tin Woodman's suite, we were allowed a 15-minute break in the servants' mess hall. For a snack, Jelaya brought out an array of stale muffin bottoms. Apparently, Dorothy ate only the tops. While the other girls ate with a chorus of oohs and ahs, I guess muffin butts were a treat around here, I took a moment to study the postings on the mess hall walls. There were a ton of brightly colored signs about proper cleaning techniques and uniform maintenance, but also a color-coded schedule of palace personnel. I tried to memorize it, particularly the times when the guards changed shift. Knowing when there could be gaps in Dorothy's protection would definitely come in handy. The big wild cards were the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman. They weren't in the habit of posting their schedules anywhere, even though I knew they were always somewhere in the palace. The Lion, too, was rumored to be around. The idea of seeing the Lion again after what he'd done to Gert made me sick. But it wasn't my job to be sick. It was my job to get past them. And I'd have my hands full enough with that as it was. One thing at a time. First, get a read on Dorothy's comings and goings, then...
Are you not eating, dear?
It was Jelaya. She'd sidled up next to me without my noticing. I will, I replied quickly, waving at the fluorescent step-by-step guide to mopping. Just feeling like I could use a refresher. I want to stay sharp for Dorothy. Jelaya nodded approvingly and handed me a muffin butt wrapped in a napkin.
Good girl, she said. Just remember to keep your strength up. It's important.
Jelaya wasn't kidding around. By the end of that first day, I was so exhausted I collapsed immediately onto my tiny bed. What had felt stiff and lumpy the night before now seemed to my aching body like the most comfortable spot in all of Oz. The calluses on Astrid's hands hadn't prepared me for how intense a full day of nonstop cleaning could be. I made it through. One full day posing as a maid, and no one seemed suspicious. Well, except for Ozma. But I hadn't seen her around at all that day, and Dorothy's guards didn't come knocking down my door, which meant Ozma had kept her mouth shut. That was a relief. Better yet, I didn't see any more of the Scarecrow's brains after that terrifying first night. Rumor was he'd locked himself up in his laboratory, wherever that was, no one seemed to know, hard at work on some project. In the meantime, we maids were instructed to leave his daily hay bale delivery outside his bedroom door. Secret science experiments were obviously ominous and something I should look into, but I was mostly just relieved the Scarecrow didn't have time for his creepy dalliances with Astrid. Through the night, the bell next to my bed remained mercifully silent. Today, I'd mastered the routine and gotten used to my new body. Tomorrow, I'd work on getting closer. The next day was more of the same. Cleaning my way through the palace alongside Hannah and the other maids, I started to put together an idea of Dorothy's day. I didn't get to see her or actually wait on her. It was more her absence that painted a picture. The bitch cast a long shadow. First, I observed the hustle and bustle in the kitchen, the cooks preparing Dorothy's breakfast. We're talking a thorough inspection of bacon here, because Dorothy apparently doesn't like it too crispy. That bacon then went upstairs on a tray,
presumably to undergo a thorough inspection by Jelaya before being allowed to be delivered bedside by a shaky maid. The first room on our cleaning circuit, as outlined in Jelaya's thorough flowchart, was Dorothy's solarium. It was her preferred location for midday tea with the ladies. I was partnered with Syndra, which meant I did most of the cleaning while Syndra gazed longingly at all of Dorothy's gaudy decorations. After the solarium, our next stop was the nearby bathroom, where Syndra and I came upon a well-to-do woman in an elegant sundress, staring into the mirror like she was trying to psych herself up before skydiving. This was one of Dorothy's ladies. She pretended not to notice us. "That's Lady Aurelium," Syndra gossiped on our way out. "Her husband used to be the master of coin." "I didn't even recognize her," I said, then took a chance. "Horrible what happened to Lord Aurelium," Syndra snorted. "Well, he shouldn't have told Dorothy what she couldn't spend the palace reserves on." I didn't press her further, but it sure sounded to me like something dark had befallen Lord Aurelium. And now here was his wife, a playdate for Dorothy. So she spends her days entertaining the important people of Oz she hadn't yet executed or driven into hiding. Around tea time, we almost crossed Dorothy's path. It was impossible not to hear her coming. Her red high heels clicked unnaturally loudly through the halls, as if amplified by magic. Not to mention, she brought with her the heavy footfalls of her bodyguards and the tittering of her entourage, a group of gaudily dressed, Dorothy-appointed beauty experts and jesters, all of them constantly jabbering about how wonderful she was. I wanted to get a look at my target, but Hannah yanked me away. Dorothy was never alone, I realized. It was unclear whether that was a tactical decision, or maybe even she couldn't stand to be alone with herself. After tea time, Dorothy either took a nap or met with her council of advisors, or possibly both. Either way, we weren't allowed on the upper floors during that time, lest we disturb her greatness. There was no way the maids didn't see how screwed up everything was, but they went cheerfully along, or at least they pretended to. Never for a moment did they doubt Dorothy's magnificence and kindness and perfection. It was like they were brainwashed. Either that, or scared out of their minds. Later that day, a whistling Jelaya and I were sweeping dirt from the narrow hallway that ran between the palace and the royal gardens, when the unmistakable clanking of metal parts came echoing in our direction. The unspoken rule among the maids was to stay out of sight of Dorothy and her advisors, particularly the metallic Grand Inquisitor and his tin soldiers. Except that wasn't an option now. There weren't any doors or exits in our little hall. Either we ran back toward the palace in the direction of the incoming metal man, or we ducked into the royal gardens, where servants were strictly forbidden. Jelaya's giddy facade melted under a fresh burst of panic. She froze, clutching her broom and staring down the hall. I grabbed her and pulled her over to the side of the hallway, our backs tight against the wall. She was shaking. "It's okay," I told her. "We haven't done anything wrong."
But what if she didn't like the song I was whistling?"
Jelaya stammered. Before I could answer, the Tin Woodman rounded the corner. The last time I'd seen him had been in battle, and for a moment I tensed up, half expecting him to come at me. But he didn't so much as glance in our direction. He didn't recognize me, couldn't recognize me. I tasted blood and realized I'd been biting the inside of my cheek.
"Please, please don't! It was just an accident!"
The Tin Woodman was dragging a young man along by the elbow. He wore the emerald-plated armor of the palace guards. He thrashed against the Tin Woodman's unforgiving grip, to no avail. From around the young guard's neck hung a cardboard sign that said, "Crime. Wandering Eye." "I didn't mean to look at her," the guard pleaded.
"Silence," came the Tin Woodman's icy reply.
As they went by, I made the mistake of meeting the young guard's eyes. I should have kept my gaze downcast and subservient like Jelaya. Desperate, the guard tried to lunge in my direction.
"Please," he screamed. "Help me! This isn't right!"
I could have done something. Cast a fireball spell, summoned my knife, and saved that guard. I wanted to save him, because I couldn't stand to see that fear in his eyes. But then the order's whole plan would have been blown. Disgusted with both myself and the situation, I looked away. The Tin Woodman shoved the guard onward, out into the royal gardens. He didn't bother closing the door all the way. After a moment, I crept over to peek outside.
"Astrid," Jelaya hissed, "what are you doing?"
I shushed her and watched as the Tin Woodman led the guard to a sunny bed of overgrown sunflowers. They stopped there, the guard still pointlessly struggling. I wondered what "wandering eye" meant. Had he checked out Dorothy? What was the punishment for that? The sunflowers shuddered, then parted. And there stood the lion, stretching in his sun-drenched napping spot. I couldn't believe it. Here I'd been dumbly sweeping away while Dorothy's beast slept right outside the door. The lion looked totally recovered from his battle with Gert. His thick muscles rippled under his coat of golden fur as he drew himself up, looming over the guard. The Tin Woodman exchanged words with the yawning lion, but I couldn't hear them. I had to stop myself from casting a listening spell, again remembering Nox's warning about using magic. Whatever they said, it made the guard collapse to his knees. A moment later, the lion crooked one claw delicately against the guard's face, the motion so smooth I almost missed it. Something that looked an awful lot like a ping-pong ball sailed in an arc away from the guard's face and into the waiting open maw of the lion. It was his eye, I realized. The lion had flicked out the guard's eye and swallowed it. I backed slowly away from the door.
"What did they do to him?"
Jelaya whispered, her curiosity proving to me that the maids weren't entirely oblivious and brainwashed.
"You don't want to know," I replied.
"We should get out of here."
So this was what I was up against. A psychotic Midwesterner with a reservoir of magic who was never alone, surrounded by loyal killers that would disfigure one of their own without a second thought. Meanwhile, I'd received no further instructions from Nox or the Order, and hadn't seen any sign of Pete, my one sort of friend in the palace. Sure, this whole assassination thing would be a piece of cake.
Chapter 28. On the third day, there was a flutter of activity among the staff. Someone important had arrived in the palace.
"The wizard," Hannah whispered in excitement as she headed off to clean the north wing, while I gathered my materials to handle the south.
"The wizard?" I asked, hoping for more details, but Hannah was already scurrying away.
Neither Glamora's lessons or Gert's had ever touched on the wizard. Honestly, I'd forgotten all about him. Hadn't he gone back to the other place in his balloon? What was he doing in Oz? As usual, I was two steps behind. But the wizard was definitely here. I decided to detour past Dorothy's solarium, knowing that if she kept to her regular schedule, she'd be in there. It wasn't on Astrid's normal cleaning route for the day, but that was a risk I'd have to take. I needed to find out more. The hallway was totally clear, and I made sure to keep my footfalls light. The door to the solarium was ajar, probably because Dorothy figured no one would have the guts to eavesdrop. I pressed myself against the wall outside the open door, peeking into the room. Inside, Dorothy was stretched out on a green velvet divan with ornate gold legs. Next to where she reclined, a tower of little finger foods and pastries overflowed with snacks. Dorothy wasn't even bothering to lift a finger. The cookies were floating right from the tray and into her mouth. I did a double take when I saw who was sitting across from her on a brocade couch. Glamora! No, of course not. It was Glinda. She was wearing a slinky pink slip dress, her red hair piled in a perfectly coiffed updo, and she was sipping primly from a pink teacup. "I don't trust him," Dorothy complained. "Why does he have to come here at all? I let him do what he wants. I let him get away with using magic. Can't he just stop pestering me?" "The wizard may be an irritating ally," Glinda replied, "but he would make a dangerous enemy. Let's keep him happy." It was freaky how much they looked and sounded like each other. Hearing Glamora's voice coming from Glinda's mouth made me miss her sister a little, even if I'd never liked her that much in the first place. "I don't see why I can't just kill him," Dorothy complained. "It would make everything so much easier. I hate him, and I hate his dumb little hats."
"The wizard is from your world," Glinda reminded her. "That makes things more complicated. His magic is unpredictable. Trying to kill him could easily backfire. As long as we keep him on our side, he's harmless. He might even be able to help us. You know as well as I do that we share similar goals."
Dorothy said. "I just want him out of my life."
"Patience, Dorothy," Glinda warned. "Why don't we take a look and see what he's up to? I agree that it's better to keep a careful eye on him."
Dorothy let out a loud sigh of frustration. She clapped her hands together, and I snuck a peek to see what they were doing. Their attention was directed at a painting of a pleasant woodland scene that hung on the wall over the fireplace. I took the opportunity of their distraction to watch more closely.
"Magic picture," she barked. "Show us the wizard."
At Dorothy's command, the picture began to rearrange itself, like the paint was still wet and an invisible brush was creating a different scene. Suddenly, the trees became a face I recognized, the Tin Woodman. Then another face formed. This was one I'd never seen before, but I had a good guess as to who it was. It was an older man with a narrow face, mischievous eyes, and overgrown, almost horn-like eyebrows. He had a small, jaunty top hat sitting on the baldest part of his almost entirely bald head. The wizard was having lunch with the Tin Woodman. Even their voices carried crystal clear through the magic of the painting. It was like watching one of those high-def TVs my mom always talked about putting on layaway. It made me nervous,